S-A-B-O-O, San Francisco, baby, baby!
Shibba, shibba! Shibba, shibba! Shibba, shibba!
Let me in!
Shibba, shibba!
I wanna be closer to you!
Shibba, shibba!
Open up your soul!
Shibba, shibba!
Let me find that part of you! The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your
mind. Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or understand something. It's the first Monday of a new month, and you know what that means. It's Scintillating Science Monday. I have a scintillating scientist in here to talk about scintillating things in a way that we'll all understand. I'd like to welcome Eli Whiston. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on the show today. Now, Eli, tell me a little bit about, before we get into the science that you do, when did you first discover that you enjoyed science or were interested in it?
Yeah, I think I realized I caught the math bug first in, like, kindergarten.
Oh.
I really loved math, like, from the start, the first math class I had.
Wait, they had math in kindergarten? I just played with blocks and painted and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, I think it was basically that, but oh, okay. I was already into it.
Oh, okay. So, like, how did that play out as a kindergartner, like, this love of math? Were you just quizzing people like, what's 5 plus 7? I already know. It's 12.
I think a lot of that. And just anything we did in class, I was excited about. It was always my favorite subject.
Oh, okay. Okay. So does this love of math carry on through your high school years, or do you reconnect with it later?
I think it carried on throughout schooling, and it was in middle school that I started to connect it to science.
Oh, like, and what was it that you were doing in middle school where you went, hey, these are like a Reese's peanut butter cup, math and?
Yeah, I think psychology was actually the first science I started getting into.
Uh-huh.
I started reading about it and seeing how they used data and these sets of data to understand people and explain their behaviors.
Okay. And they were doing that in middle school?
This was kind of on my own already.
Oh,
I started
okay.
reading about it.
I'm sensing a pattern here. So this is just a passion that you had independent of what was going on in school. Okay.
Yeah.
And was there at any point while you were in like a high school, did math, were you able to enjoy math in the school setting?
Yeah, I think high school was definitely a turning point there. I was really lucky to, there was, in my school district, there were a lot of magnet school programs.
Mm-hmm.
So there was one that specialized in math, science, engineering.
Okay.
So they had a lot of advanced math, and you could do 3 years of physics, which sounds like a nightmare to most people, but I was so excited about that. And I think once I started physics was where I realized that was really the science that I wanted
okay.
to.
Okay. So did you, you go into high school and you go to one of these magnet schools. Do you start with physics and just stay with it? Or how did that work?
So we would do the standard science for each grade level.
Uh-huh.
So like freshman year, we would do biology, but we'd also be in the physics class at the same time.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Along with chemistry, we also do physics.
Okay. Now, having never taken, I took tons of math. I took the math that I needed to take to get into college. Physics wasn't one of them, so I never got to take a physics math class. So I don't really know what they teach in physics.
Yeah. In high school physics, it's mostly what we call mechanics.
So okay.
The way that things move through space, you would start with being able to describe the speeds and distances that things are traveling in, and then you move on to forces.
Uh-huh.
So when you push on something, how far does it move? And then on to energy.
Oh, okay.
And so I think I liked that it was all things that you could really see and interact with.
Oh, okay. And so then you go on to college and you just decide it's math all the way, and then you how do you make the leap to astronomy?
Yeah, I think by the time I took all these physics classes, I was excited about physics as a whole and was trying to see what area of physics I liked. And it was in college that I really landed on astronomy, just by exploring a few different bits of it. But it felt like those were the biggest questions that there were to answer.
Okay.
And the most exciting ones.
All right. So you go to college, you do, because I know you need a ton of math before you can even look at astronomy. So you said it's about the bigger questions. So what were the first questions that grabbed you in astronomy that made you say, I want to move in this direction?
Yeah, I think it was the cosmology questions, which isn't the field I'm in now, but that's what hooked me in, which is about what makes up the universe and how old it is, all these really fundamental questions. Learned that there's only a small fraction of the matter in the universe that we even really know what it is. Most of it is this dark matter or dark energy that we're still trying to figure out what really makes it up.
Now, let's talk about dark matter for a minute, because it comes up, you know, periodically.
Yeah.
And when I was growing up, you know, dark matter and black holes and all, those were the things you were worried about because they would just suck you in. I was like a terror growing up.
Yeah.
But I now know that it's just when they say dark matter, it's just they just don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's dark because it doesn't emit light.
Okay.
So that's why it's really hard for us to describe, because we can't observe it directly. We only observe it by its gravitational influence.
Okay. So it's not emitting light. So that's what it makes it look like a black hole, because there's no light at all. Is that correct?
Kind of. Black holes, we get a more distinct signature because it's a very condensed amount of matter. Dark matter is pretty spread out.
Okay.
In general, I mean, it clumps together, but not as much as compact as a black hole.
Okay, so it's kind of like an oil slick in the cosmos.
Like, there's dark matter in this room with us right now.
Really? How do you know?
Because we know it's throughout the entire galaxy by measuring the gravitational effect that it has, and so we know it's scattered throughout every bit of space in our galaxy, including here on Earth, even though we can't directly observe it.
Okay, so you're saying right here in this room right now, there's like traces of dark matter. Are we talking like something as small as a grain of sand, or what are we talking about? Microscopic?
Yeah, it'll be microscopic. I don't remember the exact numbers, but like one particle per tiny cubic centimeter.
Oh.
Yeah.
I love that. So like sometimes maybe when you think you're seeing like that spot in your eye, maybe you're just seeing a black hole. Okay. So let's talk about, so you did the astronomy, and then what's the first thing that you did in astronomy that expanded your mind in a way you weren't expecting?
I think it started with the work I did once I came here to Berkeley.
Oh, okay.
Which is working on supernova, exploding stars. And
that's popular because everybody likes an explosion.
Yeah, they're super exciting. And they're also just these test beds of all kinds of cool physics because they're so extreme in their energies and their masses and densities. But yeah, I think the first time I was able to observe one and detect it was really when I felt like I had entered the world of science fully.
Ah, I like that. So how frequent is it to be able to see an actual explosion in space?
Yeah. So with our eyes, very rarely that they're that close. But with our telescopes at this point, we're able to detect one a few each day.
Really?
Yeah.
When did that happen? Because it seems like that seems fairly recent.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of been steadily growing as our telescopes get better and better. The rate of discovery just keeps going up.
So several each day.
Yeah.
Now, So when these explosions happen each day, is it like a chain reaction so that you can follow it? Or is it just sort of happening randomly? And because there's a number of telescopes, the telescopes just catch it. How does that work?
Yeah, it's pretty randomly distributed. They're all happening in other galaxies outside of the Milky Way. The good rule of thumb is it's one per galaxy per 100 years.
Oh.
But we're seeing just so many galaxies now that we can see a few a day.
Okay, so we live in what's our galaxy again?
The Milky Way.
The Milky Way galaxy. Yeah. So outside of our galaxy, how many galaxies have names? Like how many have we seen? And by we, I mean people with powerful telescopes.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good question. I don't think I have a good number off the top of my head. I think it would be...
Is it in the hundreds? Millions?
The tens to hundreds of billions.
Billions? So, but you, when you're looking through your telescope, how do you distinguish one galaxy from another? Is it that there's just so much empty space that galaxies clump together?
Yeah, we can see them separated just because our telescopes have gotten good enough to separate all of these different galaxies.
That is incredible. And so I know we have our own proper named galaxy, and I've seen that other things are named with weird, you know, alphanumeric sort of random things. But are there other galaxies that have like a proper name or a whimsical name the way we do?
There's a few. The one off the top of my head is Andromeda, which is our closest neighbor.
Okay.
So I think a few of our close ones we gave fun names to, but most are just M87.
So of those galaxies that are out there, what do we know about those galaxies, and how do those galaxies, or do those galaxies differ substantially from our galaxy in terms of ratio of makeup or whatever?
Yeah, we can kind of weigh the galaxies mm-hmm. by their influence on other galaxies, their mm-hmm. gravitational influence. And we can also see how bright they are to get a rough estimate on how many stars are making them up.
Okay.
And so the Milky Way falls into one broad category of galaxies that are still star forming. We're still making new stars.
Oh, are we?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. So that makes us relatively young?
On the younger side, yeah.
Oh, okay. I never thought of it as something that ages like a child. So of our neighbors, are our neighbors also young, or are there any sort of venerable galaxies that we've noticed? Or
I think most of our neighbors are also in this younger type of galaxy.
Okay. Where do the old, or do they know of older galaxies? Like galaxies and is it that the galaxies, their stars are dying? How do you distinguish this is an old and this is a new?
Yeah, we can look at all the light coming off of them, and mm-hmm. the signatures of young bright stars are distinct. They mm-hmm. they form this bluer light.
Okay.
And so you can roughly categorize the bluer galaxies are younger and still making stars, and then we call the older ones red and dead.
Okay. And which is hotter, the red ones or the blue ones? Or the galaxies?
I think the bluer ones.
Okay. So the older ones are starting to fizzle out. And when those galaxies fizzle out, when those stars start to fizzle out, what happens? Does the galaxy shrink? Does it collapse in on itself? Does anyone know what happens?
So most of those, we say they're red and dead, but they still do have a lot of stars. They're mm-hmm. just not making new ones anymore.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So we don't see the end point. Those stars will take the longest living stars will take a long time to finally die.
Got it. Okay, now we talked about all of these individual galaxies, and I kind of think of them the way I think of like blood cells in our body sort of moving around. do galaxies ever merge?
Yeah.
They do?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's how we build up larger galaxies, we think. It's from mergers of smaller ones.
Oh.
We've observed these happen over very long time frames.
Sure.
But we've seen galaxies that have just passed through each other and interacted.
Wow. So when they pass through each other, is what keeps stars from colliding, or do they collide?
So they won't end up colliding just because there's mostly empty space.
Okay.
And so they end up passing through without their matter interacting, but we see their gravity pull on each other and disrupt each other that way.
So is there a possibility that our Milky Way could pass through another galaxy? And if so, what would be the repercussions of a thing like that?
Yeah, we're pretty sure we will eventually merge with Andromeda, our closest neighbor. But we, on Earth, there won't be any significant effects, we don't think, because we'll mostly miss each other. It'll mostly be each of these galaxies has black holes in their middle,
mm-hmm.
and those will be interacting with each other mostly, as opposed to the stars.
Okay. Does every galaxy have its own black hole?
Yeah.
So is that the nucleus around which everything orbits, and is it the powerhouse?
It is definitely the nucleus where it orbits, so it's analogous to planets going around a star. The stars are going around this black hole.
Okay.
And it definitely has a lot of energy going on. It's not powering the things outside of it.
Okay.
But it does have, because there's matter falling into it and heating up, there's a lot of energetic things happening there.
Well, what matter? Okay. If there's matter falling in and heating up, what prevents the Earth from falling in and heating up?
Yeah. So it's in, the Earth is in a very stable orbit.
Okay.
Outside of the black hole. So it has enough speed that it's just going to keep going around without decaying.
Oh.
It's some, like, bits of dust and sometimes stars that fall in, but not ones that are on these super stable orbits like our star.
Okay. So in your day-to-day of looking for stars that are exploding, what is it that you, what information do you gather from those stars exploding, and what do you do with that information?
So I look for pretty particular exploding stars in my work.
There are different kinds?
Yeah, I look for the weird ones, basically.
Oh. Okay, so first tell me what a normal one looks like, and then tell me what the weird ones are.
Yeah. So the most common ones are called type 1A supernova.
Okay.
Which comes from a white dwarf gaining mass and then exploding.
How does it gain mass?
Usually from a companion star. It starts just gravitationally grabbing some of the mass it's kind of stealing from its companion.
Oh, like an avalanche?
Kind of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's a white dwarf gathers and then it explodes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the other type is a core collapse supernova, which is what you might more traditionally think of. It's a dying star.
Okay.
So it's a heavy star towards the end of its life has this core collapse supernova.
Okay.
And then, so those are already less common than the ones with the white dwarfs.
Okay.
But then I look for the ones that get brighter again after several years after they first exploded.
Why do they get brighter?
So that's the big question our whole research. But we have a few good ideas about it. So I study these with radio telescopes.
Mm-hmm.
So we're already kind of looking at different things than most of the optical telescopes that look in the same range as our eyes. So radio telescopes look at signatures from matter getting accelerated in the shockwave of a supernova explosion.
Say that again?
So the supernova sends out this shockwave of energy, and it energizes the material around it.
All right.
And that's what's giving off the signal that we see with our radio telescopes.
Okay, so it's not really the star itself brightening up. It's the stuff around. It's like the stuff around it's catching fire or something.
Kind of, yeah. It's accelerating it, but it's because of the stuff from the star moving so fast that it accelerates the stuff around it.
Okay. Yeah. Now, why is that different from a white dwarf?
So these white dwarf explosions generally don't have much stuff around them. So we don't get the signature happening. They're usually pretty isolated and there's not a whole lot to interact with.
Okay. So what is the nature of the stuff that's around the rare ones? Yeah.
So most of this comes from the star itself. In the years of its life before it exploded, it loses some of its mass.
Okay.
So it kind of starts shedding its outer layers.
Oh, like crumbling a little bit?
A little bit,
okay. I'm just like trying to put it in how my tiny brain can understand it. So like things are flaking off of it while it's getting, while it's moving toward the end of its life.
Yeah. And then once it explodes, then the rest of it interacts with that stuff.
All the flaky stuff catches on fire. But that takes years.
Yeah.
Okay, so how do you know that, is it just time that tells you that this is one of the rare ones versus a white dwarf, or what was the other one, the one with the core collapse?
Oh yeah. So these are all kinds of core collapse, but ones that have this interaction happening. And so part of that is, first, to tell from the white dwarf ones and the core collapse, we can tell from the optical telescopes. They have different signatures in the way that their light rises and falls and their color.
Okay.
And if we look at how it looks spread out over different wavelengths of light, they have different features.
Okay.
And then for the ones that I look at that are bright after many years was this big undertaking before I actually joined the team. There was this thing called the VLA Sky Survey. The VLA is one of our best radio telescopes.
Okay.
And it surveyed a huge, every bit of the sky it could.
Okay.
And so my team went and looked at every supernova we know about and checked their position in the survey.
Okay.
And they looked at over 60,000 sources, and they found about 20 that have this signature. So that's what I meant by these are the really weird ones.
Sure, sure, sure. But to get 20 still seems like that's an amazing amount to actually be able to point to, especially because when you say it takes years, are there things where it could be hundreds of years and you just don't know it yet?
It could be, yeah. The oldest one in our sample exploded, or we detected it in 1965.
Okay, yeah. Okay. And then what's the most recent one that you've got to look at?
I think in this sample, around 2016.
Oh, okay.
But we also, outside of the sample, we've looked at ones from 2023 was another close one.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So when these explosions start to happen, like, have you seen one from the beginning? Or is it someone like, hey, come over here. Look, it's happening.
Yeah, there's one I got to track from the very beginning.
Really?
I wasn't discovering it, but because these big surveys are the main things that discover them.
Uh-huh.
But I was part of the initial follow-up. That was one of my first times actually observing with a telescope. I got to follow up.
Was that exciting?
It was super exciting. Okay. I just signed up for a random night to join in on the observations.
Uh-huh.
It happened to be when the closest supernova in the past decade exploded.
Wow, so you got lucky.
Yeah,
that's very lucky. So what was it like when you show up that day, you're like, I'm just going to help. And then what does it feel like in that room?
It was suddenly very exciting, something that felt very routine. And I was just trying to keep up because it was my first time.
Oh, okay.
But everyone was very excited and anxiously waiting to get the data and see what it looked like.
So are you looking, is everyone looking through a telescope or are people looking at computer screens with data outputting? Like, how are people experiencing this phenomenon?
So it's a lot of computer screens mostly looking at the properties of the telescope and making sure it's all being observed nicely. We have a little camera that shows what we're looking at to just make sure we're lining it up correctly.
Okay.
And then you can get some live readout of what the signal looks like. It's the live signal is pretty noisy.
Okay.
Because you need to process it to really see it. Although I think in this one we could see some of it already because it was so close that it was really bright.
What do you mean it was so, like, where was it? Was it near Andromeda? Or
so
what's considered close?
It's close in a very relative sense. So it was still tens of millions of light years away, which is ridiculously far. But in the context of these supernova, it was fairly close.
Okay. Close enough that you could actually hear it and see it somewhat on a screen? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
And actually, you can see it with your naked eye, but with backyard telescopes, people were seeing this one.
Wow. So were people, like lay astronomers, calling in like, hey, we're seeing this thing?
There's an amazing data set that's all amateur astronomers assembled, like really captured all of the data of this rise and fall of the source.
Do you actually, do you guys, since you were talking about amateur astronomers, are there astronomers who have recorded a supernova or, you know, that type of phenomena from the beginning, just sort of randomly?
I think for this one, there were actually some people who were taking pictures just of the galaxy that the supernova happened to be in.
Yeah.
And it didn't necessarily see it, but once they heard about it, they checked back on the pictures and they realized.
Oh, it's like those CSI episodes. Exactly. Oh, if we zoom in, you could see it right there. That's amazing. So the room is just alive and buzzing with energy. You're there. It's super exciting. So what is it that you're doing while this is while all of this excitement is happening?
So for this one, as my first one, I was really just doing record keeping, making sure that the logs were all in order.
Because
I was leaving it to the real professionals to handle the actual observation.
Okay. So when you leave the room, do you have colleagues that you could discuss this amazing thing with?
Yeah, we have our group meeting every week, and whenever there's a new object like this, we spend the first like half hour just talking about what it looks like, what we're seeing, and all our plans to keep observing it over the next few weeks.
Okay, so you have colleagues that you can everyone can discuss the latest thing that they've seen. So in these meetings, what is something that someone else brought to talk about that you thought was incredibly exciting?
Last year, there was someone who detected what we call a tidal disruption event.
What's that?
Which is, I was talking about these supermassive black holes in the center of galaxies. Sometimes a star falls into it, and that's what the signature of these are. It's called a disruption event because the star literally gets ripped apart by the force of the black hole. And all that stellar material goes around the black hole and heats up and gets really, really bright.
Okay.
And so they found one of these that was not, it didn't look like it was in the center of the galaxy where we would expect it to be.
Oh, okay.
So that was exciting because we didn't have a good explanation for it. I think those are the events that really get us excited, or when we don't know what's going on and it's up to us to figure it out.
But this when you said this to me, I was like, but wait a minute. You said that they're not going to interact with each other. But now I'm hearing about this thing that just sucked a star in and ripped it apart. So which one is it?
So that star was on a very unstable path. Okay. Versus our sun that's in a very nice, stable orbit.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. So you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. It's Scintillating Science Monday, and we're speaking with Eli Whiston. And Eli, tell me a little bit about a typical day in the lab for you.
Yeah, so it's hard to land on a typical day because it kind of varies week to week.
Okay.
But I can walk through kind of the process.
That'd be great.
Where it starts with us proposing to telescopes, because the telescopes we want to use are these really big ones that everyone wants to use.
Okay.
And so they'll put out calls twice a year for us to write in proposals and justify what we want to look at, why it's important, what cool science we can do, and why we need them to do it.
Okay.
And so we're building this argument, and that's one of the busier days is when I'm working on those.
Okay. So proposal, please let us use your telescope. Here's why we think we deserve X amount of time on the telescope.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then if we are lucky enough to get the proposal, then there's the time spent observing, which is mostly the planning of what we want to observe, how long we want to observe it. You need to get calibration sources. So you have to plan how much time you look at your calibrators and how much time you look at your target. And then you're sending this in for approval.
Okay.
And then once it's observed, then you'll get this stream of data and you have to work on it and process it and clean up that data until it's ready to be analyzed. And then once you have that data to analyze, you have these individual data points that... And I'd say that's where the bulk of my time goes. Once we have the data, it's writing code and figuring out the right equations to use to try to understand what's actually happening in our data.
Now, what's the code writing for?
So it's mostly to fit models to the data. So we have some equation that explains the general aspects of what's going on, and we use the code to try to match those models to the data.
Okay. So are there competing models that that seem to work and you guys haven't figured it out yet? Or are there models that people used to use and now in 2026 they're like, it turns out that model was trash. Let's use this one.
Yeah. I think there's been some steady improvement, but the main one we use for our radio data modeling is still the one that came in like the late 80s with some very minor refinements.
Okay. And what is that model?
It basically captures how this shockwave is exciting the electrons.
Okay.
Speeding them up and what signal we expect to get from that acceleration of the electrons.
Okay. And then what is the practical application of this knowledge that you're gaining?
So it's hard to point to something one-to-one that we get from this knowledge, but we're gaining insight into how the universe works, how physics fundamentally works. And it's hard to pinpoint exactly how that will help us, but we didn't know how the discovery of the electron would help us. And now it's powering the lights and the signals in this room.
So, okay, now here we're going to go into astronomy, and what we know about astronomy has changed a great deal from when I was first learning about astronomy, you know, back in the Stone Ages. When I think of the universe is everything, but... is the universe everything, or are there limits to the universe?
There's functional limits to the universe.
Meaning?
That we call our observable universe.
Okay.
Because light travels at a finite speed, and so we can only see as far as light has had time to travel since the beginning of the universe.
Okay.
So we can only look far back enough. We're looking 13.8 billion light years away from us, which is about the age of the universe.
That brings me to this question. Like, how do you figure out how old the universe is?
Yeah. This comes back to that cosmology I was talking about, the big questions about. And part of it is we have all these different models that we try to use to explain the universe. And from those models, we can somewhat get an age. And it's connected to how quickly the universe is expanding.
Okay.
Everything in the universe is moving away from each other. Everything that isn't gravitationally connected to each other is moving away from each other. Okay. And if we can measure the speed that they're moving away from each other, then we can kind of reverse that and see when everything was all condensed.
Oh, okay. So does that mean we're getting further and further away from the Andromeda galaxy?
So that would be close enough that we're not moving away from each other. That's like the limit of things that are gravitationally bound are these galaxy clusters.
Okay, so we're moving as a cluster away.
Yeah.
Okay. And I've heard that we are actually sort of in the boonies of our galaxy.
Yeah.
And is so our solar system is just somewhere on the outskirts of town.
Yeah.
What else makes up our galaxy? Like, what's the center of our galaxy considered?
Yeah, so the center is where that supermassive black hole is.
Okay.
And there the stars are moving much, much faster because the gravitational influence is much stronger.
And are there planets, are there solar systems or galaxies? Like how many galaxies are there in our or how many? I don't know how to explain it, but so we've got Andromeda, we've got the Milky Way. What else is floating around our core, and does our core have its own name?
Yeah, it definitely has a name that I'm blanking on right now. But us and Andromeda are the bigger pieces, and there's a lot of dwarf galaxies, we call them, which are the smaller ones that are together in this cluster with us.
Okay. So, wait, did you just give me a number?
No, I just said a bunch of dwarf galaxies.
Just a bunch.
Yeah.
And so, but is a bunch like 15 or a bunch like 1,000?
Yeah, the bunch is on the smaller side, like 10 to 20.
Oh, okay. So something manageable.
That's my estimate.
Okay, yeah. Okay. All right, now I want to ask more about when you are doing what you do, what's some of your more favorite things to do when you're doing your research?
I'd say I really like the moment where we've done these observations, we've done the proposal, we've done all this data cleaning process, and we finally get the data and we can see what's happening with the source, especially when that thing is surprising.
And what does that data look like? I mean, is it like a spreadsheet or?
So with mine, we do get images.
Oh,
they're not the most exciting images because everything's so far away that the objects are just points.
Okay.
But we measure the brightness of those points at different wavelengths of light. And we use that. We put that together to tell a story about the object.
So when you talk about it's so far away that it's a point, but does that point have a specific color? Or do you add a color to it? Because, you know, when you see pictures of the car.
Yeah. In our images, we do add color to it because we're using radio telescopes. So the light itself would be invisible to us.
Oh, okay.
So we just color code it. Normally the background is kind of blue and then the source itself is redder.
Okay. Okay. And so that's one of your favorite things when you finally have the data and you start analyzing it. And when you analyze it, what are you looking for or what does it tell you?
So we're trying to see, we have a few different ideas of what's causing these late time bright objects, these 20 objects I'm looking at. So I'm trying to test each of those ideas and see if they work.
So what are some of the ideas? Give me like a smattering of like, is it this or is it this or is it this?
So the most common one that we think to look to for first is, I said that the star is losing its mass and mm-hmm. we're interacting with it. And if that was just happening normally, if the star lost its mass at a very steady rate, then we wouldn't get these rebrightenings. It would just slowly fade over time.
Okay.
But if the star had some enhanced period of mass loss where it was losing more further in its past,
okay,
then you'd get more material further out that mm-hmm. was expelled earlier. And that can cause it to rebrighten.
Okay.
And so this scenario is really cool because we're kind of looking back in time, the further forward in time we look, because the star is steadily losing mass. So say 100 years ago, it loses a bunch.
Okay.
And then 10 years ago, it loses some more.
Okay.
The shock first hits the stuff that it lost 10 years ago. And then it reaches the stuff.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
100 years ago.
Like it might have lost stuff in waves. And so when it starts to brighten up, it's brightening up in waves.
Yeah.
Oh, does it lose any of its brightness? Since it's hitting the 10-year stuff first, does that mean that the stuff that's maybe 100 years is dimmer because the 10-year stuff is absorbed a lot? Or is it just so powerful that it just sweeps through?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's not enough stuff to significantly slow things down.
Oh, okay.
And so it really mostly depends on how much stuff is at each point, how much mass the star was losing at each stage of its life.
And is it sort of an even, like a sphere, or is it sort of kind of a blob? Like, what is this mass, or what is this sudden brightening look like in the when you're examining it?
So we usually, our first guess is that it's a sphere.
Okay.
That's our best model, but sometimes that doesn't make sense and we need to consider other ways that the mass can be arranged. So sometimes, say the star had a companion that was going around it, then maybe more stuff gets concentrated near the orbit of the companion because its gravitational influence is drawing that stuff in.
So you're saying there could be one star that blew up, then its companion star doesn't fry when the other star blows up. It just, you know, suddenly there's all this debris and so it could start to glow. Is that what you're saying?
That's another thing that could happen. I'm saying before the star explodes and it's losing some of its mass, companion can help like sweep up a lot of that mass and make it not a sphere, but more in line with that companion.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So then is there ever a time when you have a companion star and it's created the illusion that it's the one giving off the brightening, but it was actually another star, its companion star? Does that make sense?
Can you say that again?
Okay, so you have the two stars. One has been flaking off and the companion star has been picking it up.
Yeah.
Then it's doing that thing where it's brightening the things. And it's brightening the things around the new star.
I see. Yeah.
Then, so it, to me, I would go, oh, well, maybe this other star is the one that is, how do you distinguish when that happens? Or is that something that's just rare?
Yeah, we usually associate this big period of losing a lot of mass
mm-hmm.
is towards the end of the star's life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's usually going to be the star that exploded that is interacting with its own material. It's pretty unlikely that it will happen to line up that the star and its companion are both losing a lot of mass
mm-hmm.
at the same time. But it's definitely an idea that we have to consider sometimes.
Or just that one went and the other didn't, but the other picked up all the debris, and therefore when the collapsing one or when that one sends out that energy, you know, the intact star glows like a, you know, yeah, a diamond in the sky, and you think, oh, maybe it's that one.
Yeah. Well, we can tell which star exploded usually because the way they discover these is they're taking snapshots of the sky every few days. And so we're seeing which star got brighter all of a sudden.
Okay. So as an astronomer, astronomy is like very popular because it's something, you know, every child looks up in the sky and asks why. So when you are talking with someone who's very young about what you do, how do you explain it to them? Like if you're explaining it to like someone in elementary school or kindergarten or something.
Yeah. So actually I teach in first grade classrooms once a week.
Okay.
So this is very, very relevant.
Okay.
I usually don't talk too much about what I do and it's more general space stuff. But when I talk about it, I say I study explosions in space, which gets them very excited.
Oh, yeah.
I try not to say dying stars because that makes a lot of worrying questions.
Right. But exploding stars, now that's hot. Okay.
So and make it very clear that our sun is not anywhere close to doing that.
Oh, but do they worry about that the minute you say exploding stars?
Yeah.
Oh, I would too. So yeah. I appreciate your you know, assuaging their fears. So what are some of the more common questions that the kids ask you about what's going on in the cosmos?
They love to ask about black holes.
Okay.
Like what happens if you get sucked into a black hole?
Yeah.
Like that. Where we get to talk about spaghettification, which is a little scary for them, but it's fun enough. That
yeah, I was scared of that too. I make it
very clear that that's not going to happen to any of us unless you really go out and try to fall into a black hole.
Okay, so they know just to avoid it. So that
and no black holes are coming near us.
Okay, and when you're talking to the kids, what is something that requires deeper explanation? Like, you know how you think a certain way and you need someone to help you get past that weird logic?
Yeah.
So what's one of those logic things that you need to correct for kids in terms of astronomy?
I think gravity is a big one.
Okay.
A lot of them have heard of gravity, but you think of it as this thing that's pulling you down.
Mm-hmm.
Which is true, but it's really something that's pulling everything together.
Oh, okay.
And we're just feel it as a pull down because the most stuff is right below us. All of Earth is right below us.
Okay.
So we fear that pull. But when we talk about how planets and stars form, it's all the little bits of space getting sucked together by the force of gravity.
Mm-hmm.
There's no down direction. They're just all attracted to each other.
And these are just like 6 and 7 year olds, right? Okay. Are they able to grasp that pretty easily?
Sometimes it takes a little bit, but they usually get it. I use cotton balls as a big part of it. So I have to represent little pieces of space and show them slowly coming together. And then the cotton balls converge to make bigger cotton balls.
Okay. And so when you're explaining gravity and pulling it together and you're using these cotton balls, what are some of the other things that help them really understand and help adults actually understand how gravity works and what the role of gravity is?
Yeah, it's helpful to give examples of what gravity is doing. So,
for example?
So we always start
I'm a six-year-old.
Yeah, we always start with having them stand up and jump and feel the gravity as we normally experience it as a pull down.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also say, you know, there's gravity between you and your classmate and you and the table. It's just way weaker than the gravity that you feel from the Earth.
Oh. So then when you say that, what's next? Because my question is, if there's gravity, like, how come we don't pull toward each other?
Yeah. And it's really because gravity is related to how big you are. And we're way smaller than all of these planets and stars and things that are.
Now, as an astronomer, does it drive you crazy that people believe the Earth is flat?
A little. I mean, I see it as an opportunity to teach unless they get really conspiratorial with it.
And
it's kind of hard to.
So is that something that comes up when you're studying astronomy, like the flat Earth thing? Or are there other kind of weird cosmological misapprehensions that are around besides the flat Earth thing?
I feel like most people who come to learn about astronomy are very open-minded and excited to hear what the science has to say.
Okay.
I mean, I think the flat Earth thing can be interesting to understand why we know that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really understand the process of science because it's not self-evident if you're existing thousands of years ago. We had to use science to understand that the Earth was a sphere.
Okay. So do you have any events coming up, like astronomy events or math events that you want to let our listening audience know about? Yeah.
So there's one I run called Astronomy on Tap. This is a worldwide event that we started a chapter of. That's astronomy talks in bars.
Oh, okay.
And so it's coming up next week, actually. It's the second Tuesday of every month at Two Pitchers Brewing in Oakland.
Okay.
We have two talks every time. Really cool. It's a great venue. Lots of good food, too.
Wow.
Completely free.
Excellent.
For all
excellent.
Ages.
Okay, so it's called Astronomy on Tap. What's the bar?
Two Pitchers Brewing.
And it's always there, or does it travel from bar to bar?
Ours is always there.
Okay. So you mentioned that you have different talks each time. So do you know what the talks are in advance, or...?
I usually don't know much about the content, but we know the title and a brief description from the speaker. And about a week before, we'll send out that information so you can choose the ones that are most interesting.
Oh, okay.
But all of them are really cool.
So. Okay. Have you ever given a talk at Astronomy on Tap?
Not yet. We're kind of, as organizers, we're kind of saving ourselves for when we are in desperate need of
Fair enough.
But probably soon. I'll get
okay.
Yeah.
So if people are interested in that, because I know people like to look up at the stars and drink alcohol, how would they get on your mailing list or find it online?
Yeah. So you can look up Astronomy on Tap East Bay on Facebook or Instagram.
Okay. I wonder if there's one in San Francisco. There probably is.
There is a chapter that started up recently, actually. Oh, I think a lot of them closed in like 2020.
Sure.
And are restarting now.
Oh, okay. So. Okay. And then for our amateur or our aspiring astronomers out there, were there any books, or actually in astronomy, aspiring mathematicians, were there any books or websites, things that you think are great introductions into either field?
I definitely did a lot of Neil deGrasse Tyson stuff, his books, and he has a podcast, Star Talk, that I listen to a lot. There's Minute Physics on YouTube.
Ooh, I haven't heard of that one.
They do cartoons drawing out the physics of the situation.
Okay. I'm going to try Minute Physics. That's all I can take in at any given time. All right. Well, Eli, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. How do your folks feel about you studying the cosmos?
I think they're very proud. They've always been very supportive. I think they're listening right now.
So. Oh, yay. Do you have any siblings that you can talk to, astronomy with?
I have an older brother and a little sister, and they're not quite as into science as me, but they're always excited to hear what I have to say about it.
Well, yay! Well, then I am super glad that you have tons of support and a willing ear from your family. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun.
All right, people of Earth. Astronomy. It just doesn't get any better than that. You know, I wanted to be an astronomer when I was young, but then when I went to college, I found out just how much math I'd have to take before I could even look at astronomy. And I was like, oh, okay, this isn't going to work for me. So I'm glad that there are other people who clearly love numbers, clearly love looking at numbers and looking at the stars and figuring out what all there is to learn and to teach. And I'm super glad that you're able to explain what you do to little kids, because that I think that's a good foundation for science, is understanding it when you're little. So I'm right there with you. Mr. Ford is in the house. He's going to pleasure your ear hole. I am going to go out into the wilderness. I am hoping that y'all have a great time. It's not supposed to rain for the rest of the day. It's just supposed to be partly cloudy, and then it's going to sunny up a little bit. But I think it's going to be super duper hullabalooper. I am going to leave you, my friends, with some Gladys Knight and the Pips. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.
Melodies bring memories that linger in my heart and makes me think of home and such. Why do we ever part? Well, some sweet day when blossoms fall and all the world's a song, I'll go back there, I guess, 'cause that's where I belong. Other